Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Just a heads up, there's a lot of fonts in this section, again, so that's not going to be very interesting, and I will try to treat them briskly. And that starts right now with the first package in the list, Noto, -CJKFontsTTF, and then NotoFontsTTF. Those are the first two packages. The CJK package is referring to Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, CJK. And that's what these are, is Noto characters for those languages. And then Noto-FF, or TTF, is of course the other language, the other character sets for Noto. And Noto apparently is an abbreviation called No Tofu, which is quite ironic, considering Noto CJK. But tofu apparently is the term that somebody gives to the little boxes, the blank empty boxes that you see when a character just doesn't exist within a specific font. So Noto's goal is to never have a blank box. Every character that appears on any keyboard, or I guess in a language that can be typed through input, ought to have a glyph. And that's what Noto, that's the goal of the Noto project. This is a project apparently begun by Google. Its home page is at fonts.google.com/Noto, N-O-T-O. And it's not a bad page, to be honest. It's pretty darned interesting because it talks a lot about sort of the goals of the project, how they're trying to approach the problem of creating a font, an open source font with everything, every glyph you could possibly want. And I don't know how well Noto achieves this goal. I feel like I've tried to fall back on Noto for some things and it still fails. And it could just be that it is divided into several packages, and possibly I didn't have the package that was required for whatever it was that I was doing at the time. I don't remember what it was. But if you are interested in languages and glyphs and, you know, letters, alphabets, things like that, it is not a bad page to visit. I mean, it's a little bit self-congratulatory and a little bit, it's got a lot of fluff in it because, I mean, that's what you do on a website, right? But there are some interesting points being made, and just how preserving a language is important and also complex in a computerized world. And it makes me think, and I'm going on way too long for a font package. I said I wouldn't do that, but it does. It is fascinating to me. I can't help it. It's interesting. I think that I am very much, and have been for a very long time, of two minds about kind of like languages, because there's the aspect of a language where it is a purely functional thing. It is a tool for one person to communicate an idea to some other person, and as a tool, a universal thing, a universal tool for that job, seems like it makes a lot of sense. It just kind of does. But the moment you say, well, there should just be one language so that we can all understand each other, then you get into the whole problem. This is quite an interesting analogy, really, for open source. I think you get into the problem that we get with open source, where we say, well, there should really just be one desktop for Linux, because otherwise people get confused. Or there should really only be one programming language, and that way everyone could just learn one thing. You know, whatever it is that you think, well, there should really just be one of them. You get into that problem of, yeah, but which one would you pick? Because there's not one that is the best at everything. There are lots that are good at lots of different things, but there are nuances. And I've said this during our during the coffee breaks before. Like, the English language apparently doesn't do all that well with describing flavor. And if you want to describe a flavor of something, you have to make it similar to something else. Like there's just no way of describing a quote-unquote bright flavor or a deep flavor other than using bright and deep. What are those? Deep is a measurement of distance, and bright is a measurement of specularity or of radiance, I guess. So does it really make sense to use those, you know? So, and maybe there's a language out there that has better nuance for flavor, for taste. Who knows? I don't know. But certainly there are lots of things that different languages do well. And so it is a cultural thing, right? There's also a cultural angle to languages, which is important to preserve as well. It might be silly that we have lots of different languages. It's an artifact, unquestionably, of the past and of the inability to sort of influence one another over great distances a long time ago. But I mean, that becomes part of a culture, and to lose that seems pretty tragic as well. So there's just so many reasons. So many different angles to languages, and it just fascinates me. And so if you're curious, or if you're fascinated by that topic, Noto, fonts.google.com/Noto is actually a pretty interesting read. Or it's interesting, you know, for a quick glance. I'm not going to say it's like in depth, but it is definitely worth kind of glancing at and pondering. Okay, next package. Well, those were all the N's, by the way. We're in the O's now. So I think spending actually 7 minutes on fonts on languages, maybe that wasn't so bad, because I mean, that was literally all the N's. Okay, O. So O'Clock is the first package, and it is a little, I'm assuming, kind of maybe a demo application. Of course, I mean, it maybe it's also just a purely of an actual, like a functional kind of like little widget for a very simple window managing environment, actually, or like a desktop, window manager. So if you're not running GNOME or XFCE or KDE, Plasma, then you might have a need for a clock. And if you've ever set up, well, if you've never set up Fluxbox or OpenBox or TWM, remember that one. I mean, literally remember that. It's going to come up soon. Then you might never have experienced this, but there are, you know, like there are window managers out there that people use really in lieu of a desktop. How does that work? What does that mean? Well, it means that you get a graphical server running. So you see something on your display, like graphics on your display. Generally, it's a blank screen, and that's your desktop. Okay, that's not that big of a deal, right? Well, how do I start my applications? That's the thing that you have to figure out. So there are different means for this, depending on what window manager it is. But generally, there's something called a root menu where you click somewhere in this blank emptiness, or you right click and you get a little menu. And that menu ideally lists applications. And again, depending on the window managing environment, or the part of that provides the menu, that might be an auto-populating menu. It might be something that you have to configure. It might be something that you choose to configure. It might be as simple as, you know, click somewhere for a terminal and then launch all your applications from a terminal. It just really depends. But when you've got like a blank screen and no panels, no dock, no, there's just nothing there. It's you and maybe a menu when you click somewhere. Then it just there. You need other things. You need like little widgets, or you don't maybe need them, but you want them. Like you want to tell what time it is, for instance. And sure, you could launch a terminal and just type in date. There's the time. But we like clocks. We humans like to see the passage of the thing that we call time, so we make clocks. And O'Clock is a very simple clock widget for your desktop, for your desktop. We'll call it a desktop. It might not be a desktop environment, but I mean, it's the screen in front of you with a graphical server running. So if you open a terminal right now and type in O'Clock, that's O-C-L-O-C-K, Then you get a little clock on your screen, and that is O'Clock. Leave it on there long enough, and the hands on the clock, they'll move. You can do a couple of different options. There are a couple of different options when launching it. You can do a dash geometry and then provide a width X height. That changes the size of the clock face. You can do dash FG for the foreground color and the dash BG for the background color. You can do the color of the hour hand and the minute hand. You can even do a jewel. This is the this is a little jewel on the 12 o'clock at the top of the clock face. And when I say jewel, I mean like 2 or 3 pixels. It's just a spot on the clock face, but it is called jewel dash JEWEL, which I thought was kind of quaint. So that's what O'Clock is. I've got more to say about sort of like the concept of these little applications, but I'll save it for later because I think another one's coming up. All right, next up is, so that was the O's. That was all the O's. N, O, and now we're into the P section with Pixman. That's P-I-X-M-A-N. That's not a pixel manager. It is not a video game. It is a pixel manipulation library. This is a low-level pixel manipulation routine used by both Xorg and, or Xorg, and Cairo. This is basically, I mean, it's a .so file, it's a library file, and then the header files in user include. That's all this is. It helps rasterize, I think, trapezoids and, I don't know, something else. Let's see if I can quickly remember here. No. Pixman API, Pixman filter, dither, conjoin, struct, region, box, rectangle, region. Well, I thought I saw a trapezoid in here somewhere. Anyway, it helps render things. There it is right there. Pixman underscore composite underscore trapezoids, Pixman underscore composite underscore triangles, and so on. So this is a graphic library for x.org and Cairo. That makes sense. We're in the X folder. Okay, what's next after Pixman? PyXDG. This was, I don't mean this in a very disparaging way, but this was a little bit of a disappointment. PyXDG is a Python module that provides access to a bunch of attributes about XDG, XDG being the, I don't remember what XDG actually stands for right off the top of my head. But if you launch Python 3 and then do from XDG, actually, you know what? Let's do an import XDG. That imports the PyXDG model, module. Then you can do help, parentheses XDG, and you get a list of all of the packet, you know, the package contents within PyXDG. So that includes things like base directory, config, desktop entry, exceptions, icon theme, ini file, locale, menu, menu editor, mime, recent files, and util. That is util. Enunciation is important. Okay, so I'm going to do from XDG import. This is another thing that bugs me about Python. Surely it should be import blah from XDG, but instead they write it from XDG import. I don't know why anyone would do that. It should start with the word import, obviously. That would be consistent. So let's, I don't know, do ini file. Okay, now I've imported ini file. So I could do a help ini file, parentheses, ini file, close parentheses. And this talks about this being a base class for desktop entry, icon theme, and icon data. So this class object, this object of an ini file, can contain things like, well, certainly a file name, the ability to add a group, to check a Boolean, to check an integer, to check a key, to check a point, to check regex, to check string, get file name, get list, and so on. Okay, that's not all that interesting. Maybe it was desktop. No, it was base directory, I think. Yeah. Let's do from XDG import base directory. Now let's do help on base directory. I'm looking for something that I remember. Yeah, here it is. Here it is. Okay, so this is this module is based on a ROX module, R-O-X. ROX was a, I'm going to say early, but I don't know what that really means. Like, how early is early? I don't know. But it was an early desktop, actually, ROX was. And it's surprisingly influential, I think. I don't feel like that many people really talk about it all that often anymore, because I don't believe that it's even developed anymore. But it was quite the influential desktop. It was kind of, if I recall correctly, and so ROX was before my time with Linux, so it must have been earlier than 2006. But I mean, it was still kind of a thing when I very, very first started. So there was a little bit of overlap. But as I recall, it was kind of the progressive and sort of beautiful desktop, because it did really interesting things, like it had photorealistic icons in some places, or rather it had photos that it used as icons, you know, like it actually had images rather than like sort of drawn icons. And it had some pretty progressive concepts, like what if we had just a folder with all the application code inside, with all the compiled application components in this folder, and then we just renamed that folder dot, I think it was just dot app, then it would render that folder as if though it was a single object. That became your application. So it was very, very highly portable, sort of self-contained, like everything you need. I mean, there were still dependencies. I don't believe that there were .app files. I could be wrong, but I don't remember it being like everything you need to run this application is in that folder. But like all of the components that shipped with that application were in that folder, and therefore you could run that application from that folder. There was like no sort of install in the sense that you didn't take little bits and pieces of the application deliverables and scatter it throughout your system. It was all just in that one folder. And if that sounds vaguely familiar to you, that's because app image is essentially based on ROX. I mean, like that's a direct inspiration for app image. I don't have a citation for that, but I'm pretty sure app image used to, I don't remember if it was in a comment in the code or whether it was on the website. I'm pretty sure that was a thing, a quote that Pro Bono said. I could be wrong, but that's what I kind of remember. So I whether I'm wrong or not, the point is that's kind of, you know, whether it was like the inspiration for app image or whether it was just an influence on, or you know, it did exist and it is similar. So there's that. There's also this thing, this module, this XDG thing was an early influence here was ROX, where they decided that there were going to be a set, a sort of a base level kind of category of things like a configuration folder, a data folder, you know, things that you can set as an environment variable for your computer to know about, but things about about the user's environment. So you get environment variables like xdg underscore cache underscore home and xdg underscore config underscore dirs and xdg underscore config underscore home and data dirs and data home and so on. And that's what this Python module is looking at. And that's all I have to say about it, honestly. It's not as interesting as I'd hoped. I mean, it is interesting for kind of the history lesson, but in order, I mean, to use it, there's not a whole lot to do unless you're actually, you know, using it to build something. I was hoping for sort of like, oh, we'll just get a list of, we'll discover what the config home is on this system, but it doesn't really do that sort of thing. Next up is RenderCheck. RenderCheck is a test application. It tests a render extension implementation against separate calculations of what kind of output is expected. That's the package description, but also pretty close to what the man page says, except the package description says it better. But according to the man page, simple tests of the X render extension. So it is designed for authors of render implementations in an X server. So in other words, if you're programming something to render graphics within the X11 environment, you could run render check to ensure that that your application is indeed rendering what is expected. I could not figure out sort of what's expected. Like I don't understand from this package, from the research that I've done on this, which, well, I mean, granted, is not a lot, but I mean, I looked, and I just couldn't figure out how to produce an error or how to recognize when an error occurred. Could be that it just tells you in the terminal, but I guess maybe I got lucky and experienced no errors, at least for the duration that I ran it. It goes on for a long time. I mean, really, I just let it run in the background eventually and just sort of ignored it. And at the end of, like, it must have been like either 40 or 60 minutes, I just got tired of watching it blink. And I quit it eventually, because it did get a little bit, it seemed like it was never going to end, to be honest. Next up is RGB, the X color name database. That, you know how in some applications like URXVT or I don't know, something else, you can sometimes define a color by a, let's call it a human readable or a human friendly name. Like you can do Emacs-FG, foreground, cyan, dash BG, red. That's a horrible idea. Oh, wow, that is bad. Yes, that is very bad. I will never do that again. Control X. So you can put in color names, and the computer knows what values to assign that. That's thanks to this package, the RGB. It's a color name database with associated RGB values. You can see all of these with the command show RGB, and you might want to pipe that through less or something like that. And sure enough, 255250 is snow, 248, 248, 255 is ghost white, 245, 245, 245 is white smoke, and it just keeps going from there. Interestingly, there is no color for 255, 255, 255, I don't think. Let me try. I guess I can search for 255. Oh, there is. It's just white. That's just white. That's kind of boring, isn't it? So 255, 255, 255 is white, 000 is black, 47, 79, 79 is dark slate gray. You can just go on like that. I mean, it just goes on and on. There's got to be, well, I could tell you exactly, I guess. Instead of piping that through less, I'll do WC-L for 782 color names. So next time you're defining a, like a color scheme, like with dash FG and dash BG, try do a show RGB and pick a different color that you haven't tried lately. For instance, if you were doing O'clock dash FG, you could do Rebecca Purple and dash BG. I'm trying to come up with something that wouldn't be horrible. Yellow one. There you go. That might work. Probably, I don't know, bright green probably would have been better. Oh, there's light green. Yeah, there you go. BG, well, let's do BG, Rebecca Purple, FG, BG, Rebecca, oh, I don't know how important capitalization is. Rebecca Purple, and dash FG, light green. Yeah, that's not bad. That's not bad at all. That'll work. I mean, it'll work for the 5 seconds that it's on my screen. Okay, next up, let's look and see what's next. RGB, we did that. Sazanami fonts, TTF. I don't know that I said that correctly, but that's another font package. It's for hiragana, katakana, and kanji, or han, which I don't know what that is. But, I mean, kanji I've heard of. I don't know what han is. So that's Japanese sorts of characters, and I don't know the difference between any of those. Next up is sesreg. That's S-E-S-S, so I guess it should be sesh. Sesh reg. This is a session regulator, I guess? What is reg? Registration? I'm not sure. So it's written for XDM. XDM being a very basic kind of, session manager for a desktop. You can use XDM instead of, for instance, SDDM or LightDM, or is GDM still around? Is that still a thing? I'm not sure. KDM used to be a thing. So you can use XDM to log into your computer. When you boot, you can have it boot to XDM, and you can tell XDM to give you a certain set of options so that you can choose which desktop environment you want to use and so on. XDM is really, really basic. It is not pretty. It's a login field. It does what it's supposed to do. And SeshReg, the simple program for managing UTMP and WTMP entries for an X session, apparently this can be used for other display managers like GDM or KDM. Again, KDM doesn't actually exists anymore. I'm pretty sure it's been kind of replaced by SDDM. It certainly has in Slackware, but I think that's pretty much across the board. And SeshReg, if you type it in with no arguments, it'll give you a help, and it tells you that you can either do a dash A or a dash D. That's add and delete. So you can either add an entry or delete an entry from either the UTMP file or the WTMP file, which of course are the things that you see when you do a command like W or who. Both of those show you logged in users and the login time and what terminal, what Getty they're looking at, or what they've logged into, and so on. So you can, you wouldn't call SeshReg yourself. You would instead make it a line in, I think, X. Yeah, in X startup, you would put SeshReg-A-L$$etc/etc/x11xdm/xservers$user. So you're adding a user on this display to at a specific X server, which actually is not required anymore. I don't think that's deprecated. It's supported for legacy, but not it, you don't actually need to define it. So you're adding that to the UTEMP file. Then in X reset, you could do SeshReg-D to delete -L display. I'm going to skip the X servers and then $users, and that would remove the user once the X session has been reset. So it is a command that you can have something else use to keep track of when someone has logged in and has then logged out. I've never used SeshReg directly. I don't know if it's even required anymore. Maybe that's just, I imagine on most distributions, if you install XDM, you're just going to get SeshReg working regardless. It's just something that you don't have to think about, but it is there. Something is using it probably. But these days I don't even know if anything's using it. I couldn't really find a sign of it. I looked in /etc/x11 or whatever it is and looked around trying to find the line where SeshReg was called, and I couldn't. Maybe I missed it, but I couldn't find it in any of the sort of obvious places. So I don't know if it's even being really used, or if it just is one of those things that truly Pat kind of included because, well, it comes along with X11. Next up is set XKB map. This changes your X11 keyboard map, or your keyboard layout rather. This we've kind of talked about this before. The XKB layout defines what happens when you press a certain key, and so set XKB map is the thing that tells your computer what kind of physical hardware keyboard you have in front of you. And that's an interesting thing because I think there are probably a lot of different ways to convey that kind of information. And this is a very sort of transparent and open way to do that. It's just, look, we all know that the computer doesn't know what keyboard you're actually using. So if you can set XKB map yourself, then you can tell the computer you're using anything. And as long as it makes sense to you, then the computer will respond in kind. The command that ships with this package is set XKB map. So you can start out, I guess, by doing a set XKB map space dash query, Q-U-E-R-Y. And that tells you a little bit about what the computer at least believes that you're using, which you have probably set in this day and age, during install, first of all. But maybe you've changed it in system settings of your desktop. So there's a good chance that you're not using set XKB map at all, but you could. And so what it's telling me here is, again, this is exclusively what I have told it. This is not anything that it knows to be true outside of what it's been told. It says rules evdev. So remember evdev from a couple of episodes ago, this was the event device subsystem that monitors things that provide near constant streams of input. Model PC101, that's the generic PC keyboard with 101 keys. I have not counted the keys on this keyboard myself, but I have been told that the usual layout, you know, kind of that Model M sort of layout where I think it's Model M, you've got the main keyboard part where you are typing all your letters and your numbers, and then you've got all those function keys along the top that nobody ever uses, and then the little funky accountant number pad on the far right hand corner. That's the PC101 layout, I guess. Layout is US comma US. That's true. It's got a dollar sign above the four and no euro symbol or anything like that. This is just US keyboard. Variant Dvorak. Well, that's not strictly true. My keyboard isn't Dvorak, but that's how I use it. So yes, that is true, Dvorak. And then options, terminate, control, alt, backspace, caps, control modifier, compose is the right alt key. Yep, all of those things I've set for myself. Again, in this day and age, I've actually set most of those, or maybe all of those, in the system settings. Well, actually, I mean, the layout I did during install, so I don't know, Pat Volkerding did that for me, but how, and probably just Pat Volkerding uses set XKB map, maybe. Well, no, because the X isn't running during the install. So I don't know how he does that, but it happens, and it got set and it got carried over very nicely. And then to add my compose key, I just went to system settings. I could have done that with some X settings, but again, just kind of in this day and age, you go to a single place, your system settings, you do all your little quick modifications that you want to do, and then you're done. You never think about it for the next, you know, 5 or 7 years. I guess the annoying thing about set XKB for me is that it doesn't, and this is not uncommon, sadly. A lot of commands sometimes seem to do this. It doesn't reverse parse for you, meaning if you don't know what your options are, good luck. I mean, technically your options are listed on your system. I mean, set XKB doesn't just make stuff up when you tell it to that the type of keyboard is PC101 or what was that, model or something like that, whatever they call that. Now I can't remember. Model. The model is PC101. Well, if I didn't know it was PC101, how do I get there? Yeah, I mean, really, how do you get there? Like, I don't know. What if I have a PC102? Is PC102 a thing? What if I have a PC64? Like, is that a thing? You'll just never know from set XKB. You're just meant to know for yourself what kind of keyboards exist. And that's troublesome because set XKB does know what the valid options are. It's just there's no way, as far as I can tell, there's no way to get that information. Not from set XKB map, I mean. So if you want that information, you can do a less on /etc/x11/xkb. And if you tab a couple of times, you see really a bunch of useless directory names, compat, geometry, key codes, rules, symbols, types. Well, I don't know. I'm looking for model. That's what I want to define. Or maybe I want a layout. Or maybe I want a variant. Doesn't matter. None of these appear to be those. So, okay, let's look in compat. Anything in compat? No. Well, there's PC in compat. All right, let's look at that. PC or PC98 in the P? No, just PC. Okay. So we'll do a less on PC. And that doesn't seem to be anything about like the model. In fact, all it does is it sets the alt virtual modifier. Virtual modifiers alt, set mods, clear locks equals true, interpret alt underscore L plus any as a virtual modifier equals alt action, set mods modifiers equals mod map mods. So that's not very useful. What about something else? Like maybe geometry. Geometry, well, once again, I mean, I don't know what geometry is referring to, but once again, there is a PC entry in there. So let's do a less on that. Ah, here's something. Default XKB underscore geometry PC 101 right here at the top. Why they're calling it geometry, I don't know. Why don't they call it model? Like that would make more sense to me. And this is a default. So the default is, the default XKB geometry is PC101. So if we do a search for maybe XKB underscore geometry, then we find, yeah, PC101. The next one is PC102, so that does exist. Ooh, PC104 exists, 105, PC86, PC104 alt, and that's it. So those are the, I don't know what that was, six or eight layouts, I guess, or models, sorry, that this system appears to know about, at least with the PC, within the PC sort of like series. So let's do geometry sun, and let's see if that's, yeah, so there's more here. So there are several geometries defined for a Sun Microsystems keyboard. Is there an IBM? No. Is there a, what else is there? Macintosh. There's a bunch of different Apple Extended. There's Apple Pro, MacBook 78. So yeah, in other words, the data obviously exists. They're here, it's got a lot of information in it, and you really have to look around to find what the valid arguments and parameters for set XKB map are. And I have to say there's a lot of stuff, especially in those early Linux tools, I feel like just they don't provide you with the tools that you would imagine they would provide you with, you know, in order for you to sort of intuitively figure something out. And that annoys me. It does. I mean, it's hard to, you know, I mean, if it was all written down in a big book and they thought, well, that book is going to be the place that everyone would look anyway, so why would we need to do an introspection parsing run to report back on, you know, what this provides. I don't know, maybe it all made sense then, but it certainly doesn't appear to make sense now, especially with so much diversity in the peripherals you could possibly end up buying. Okay, next package, show font. It displays data about a font from an XFont server. This is the XFont server, XFS, confusingly, not the file system. It's XFS, the XFont server. I tried running one. I did. I tried for several hours to start an XFont server because I was really, really curious about all these font server functions. I've already covered a couple and kind of just skimmed over them, and I didn't want to have to do that for show font. I thought this could be interesting. Could not get it to work. Tried it as sudo, tried it as a normal user, tried it on port 7100, tried it somewhere else, tried it on localhost, tried it in a virtual machine, and then tried to connect to that virtual machine from my host computer. I've tried it all. I could not get the thing to run without an error. I did start it. It did start, but then I could not connect to it or query it in any way. And I'm imagining there's some protocol I'm not understanding that I have to use. And XFS isn't making it any easier. So I don't know what show font looks like. I don't know what an XFS feels like when it's running. All I know is that apparently on X11, you could, and I'm using the past tense more or less out of spite here, you could, back on the old days of X11, which I'm still running, but you know, the future is Wayland, and I'll just blindly be optimistic about Wayland. X11, I mean, Wayland works on my laptop, so I guess it must be all right. Whether it's easier to configure and use than X11, I don't know. I haven't even looked into it. But show font shows presumably some data that you about a font that you have access to over a font server, a remote font server, or presumably a local font server. But I couldn't get it to run locally either. So show font gives you data about a font. XFS, the X font server, runs a font server so that other computers on the network can load, in theory, a font from that remote location. These days, I don't know that anyone uses anything like that. I think it does seem like a good idea. It honestly does for a big production house that needs assets to be widely available no matter what. That sounds like such an obvious and and just a clear choice. Like, yeah, let's just run a font server, and that way people can have access to the same fonts, the same approved fonts for our work, no matter where they are within our organization or on the VPN. But in practice, I just don't know how it. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to get it to work. It would not work. And it was frustrating because I really did. I spent several hours trying to get this thing to work. And sometimes, and this is old school Linux frustration right here. Like you're trying something and you're doing what the documentation appears to tell you to do, and yet it doesn't work. And then you're kind of that's it. You're kind of, you don't know what else to do next. You know, there was nothing in the error log telling me what had gone wrong. The only thing I could ever get up to show in the error log was when I would try to start an XF, a font server while a font server was already running. Then it would put an error in the log that a font server is already running. But everything else I tried, just nothing ever showed up in the error log. I tried running it as a daemon, not as a daemon. I just could not get output from this thing when I was trying to connect to it. I couldn't connect to it locally. It was just, it's really frustrating. And when I run into that sort of problem, my mind, I tend to sort of blame really the lack of good documentation, which may or may not be fair. Honestly, I don't know. Like, maybe there is documentation. Maybe I'm just not looking in the right place. But or maybe the font server just isn't intended to really. Maybe it's just not a thing that happens and everyone knows it, and so it's just not that well supported. But that's the kind of thing where if you've got man pages that tell you XFS is the X window system font server. It supplies fonts to X window system display servers. The server is usually run by a system administrator and started via init or in inetd users. And no, that it's not in inetd config on Slackware anyway. Users may also wish to start private font servers for specific sets of fonts. So I assume it should be something that I could run locally. To connect to a font server, see the documentation for your X server. It likely supports the syntax documented in the font server name section of X7. Okay, great. Well, that's not really all that big of a deal. If you go to man X then and look for font server names, it's really just, okay, host name colon port. I mean, that's exactly what's always how you connect to anything. That's normal. So, and it doesn't say where to put that or how to make that happen. It just mentions that that's the protocol for a font server, but it doesn't tell you how to actually, like, where am I putting that? How am I getting there? So supposedly, font show should be able to, wait, no, show font rather. --help. I should be able to just do a --server, give it the server name, and then I think a --port somewhere and give it the port name, or am I making that up? Oh, I tried doing a colon port and neither of those worked. And like I say, I never got an error in any error log, so I don't know. It's just not, it is not something that worked out for me. And it annoys me. I don't like it when open source technology doesn't explain itself well, because I think that's kind of the opposite of the point. Really, I do. I want excellence in open source, and this is not it. Not explaining how to use the technology, that doesn't do anybody any good. So that I don't know why. Probably because it was probably the amount of hours I spent on the effort, but that kind of annoyed me more than really a lot of any of the other packages in here. That one kind of got me. Okay, next up is Sinhala LK Lug Font TTF. This is a free Sri Lankan Sinhala Unicode font. It was initiated by the LK, and I don't know what that is, but LUG is Linux User Group, in 2003. So another font for a different glyph set that people in Sri Lanka would be using. And then there's the SKK DIC, Dictionaries for SKK. What is SKK? SKK is the Japanese, or it is a Japanese input method. I don't know if it's the only one, but it is a Japanese input method on Emacs. It's an abbreviation of simple kana to kanji conversion. That's what SKK is. And I've certainly never used it. I don't know how, I wouldn't know simple kana or kanji. I wouldn't know the difference. Certainly wouldn't want to tackle either of those two in Emacs, because that sounds like a really bad way to try to learn that system. And then finally, I mean, I didn't even realize I didn't take a coffee break. I didn't even know I blew right past the coffee break, but this seems like a good end, because this is the last of the S's. So that's NOP and S all in one episode. That's not bad. This is SM proxy, and that stands for, I think, session. Yes, it does. Session management proxy. This is a little application, a wrapper application, to allow an X application that doesn't support X11 session management to participate in an X11 session. Now, I don't exactly understand. I mean, I imagine I understand it, but I don't truly understand that. I don't know how an application does or does not support session management. I'm assuming what happens is that when X11, when you close a window manager that you're using a session manager for, ideally, with session management, the applications, or the location of those applications, which ones have been were launched at the time that you closed, and so on, would be recorded, so that when you relaunch that window manager, those applications, the one that you left the session, you know, when you closed your when you shut things down, those same applications ought to come back up in more or less the same location on your screen, across virtual desktops, and so on. Apparently, some X applications don't support that. I'm assuming, like for GNOME and KDE libs or framework, whatever we call it these days, I'm assuming that when you're building an application with those frameworks, with like GTK or with Qt, you're probably inheriting the knowledge of session management without really even thinking about it. I've never really looked into it. I didn't even know this was kind of like a thing. I don't know. I thought session management was a little bit more magical than that. But I guess you actually have to have it in code. Who would have thought? But I'm imagining that you don't personally have to add that. It's probably something that you inherit. But in X, maybe you wouldn't necessarily inherit that. So some people might have thought to include session management in their application, and others may not have. So if you launch an application with SM proxy, then you're able to sort of tap into you're wrapping that application in something that is knowledgeable about session management, and therefore it feels like your application is sort of participating in that session. Yes, that application has been launched. It was launched when I shut down. It will supposedly relaunch when I start back up. Now, I don't know if that's true. I've never tried it. I've never tried SM proxy, to my knowledge, so I don't know. But the way that you use XSM, or rather SM proxy, is it would be used, as you might imagine, with the X session manager, which is XSM. I think, did we talk about this already, or is this coming up? I don't remember. It must be coming up, because XSM, yeah, we might not have talked about it at all. But either way, XSM is the X session manager, and it uses xsession.xsession as like the file that it uses to track what a session includes. So that would be the file that SM proxy would try to restore, as far as I understand it. Again, I haven't actually tried this, in order to kind of restore your session, the previous session. For SM proxy to be running on your machine so that it can like restore things from the session file, you would probably want to launch it as a default application within your XSM startup file, or rather your .xsm startup file, which again, I've never used, because this isn't something I've never used X sort of directly in this way. But you could, for instance, in your .xsm startup file, define applications to start when X starts up, or rather when you log in through XDM. when an X session starts. So things like TWM, SM proxy, X term, those things would launch without your interaction. TWM would provide you the window management. SM proxy would ensure that things that don't recognize an X session are still seen by your X session and therefore recorded in your .x session file. And then xterm is just in there because in the man page, it's an example. Xterm, then you would have a terminal open suddenly, which is handy with those window managers. As I say, a very bare bones kind of window manager like TWM or Fluxbox or something like that, there often isn't that much of an interface. So having a terminal close at hand where you can launch applications or run scripts or do whatever you do on your Linux box is frequently like that's one of those applications that you just kind of want on and up all the time. And in fact, for a very long time, it was kind of a little goal of mine to get it to get a desktop environment where, I mean, and this, I still kind of want this, where just the desktop is a terminal. Like, you know what? Like, let's make the root window, as it were, let's make that a terminal interface. I kind of don't understand why that's not a thing. Like, why do I have to have a terminal application running when I could just flip over to a different virtual desktop and just start typing and I'd be in a terminal? And in other words, if there's no other application on top of my desktop, why isn't the desktop my terminal? I don't know. It might not really make sense. It's not something I'm necessarily advocating for. It's just an interface gimmick I would like to see happen. I would like to try it. Maybe it wouldn't, maybe functionally it wouldn't be very useful because maybe I'd forget where that terminal window was, or I'd want to bring it over to another desktop, or well, I mean, you could just mirror it on all desktops. It could just be the constant, even though you're flipping through virtual desktops, there's your terminal session. But then you'd probably want tabs, and maybe it would just be hard to bring that into focus. I don't know. There very well could be lots of problems with the idea, but for a while, that was like an idea that I had that I really wanted to make happen, and I just could never figure out how to make it happen. But anyway, what I'm saying is TWM, SM proxy, Xterm, bang, bang, bang. They all open, they all launch when you log in to your XDM, your X session. And now when, even if you're running an X application that someone didn't think to include the call to what is it? The WM underscore client underscore leader, thing, then that's okay because instead it will utilize the WM underscore save underscore yourself protocol. Oh no, that's the things that do support it. Either way, the things that don't support that those window management calls, because the programmer didn't think to include those, that you know, didn't think to provide that API within their application, they'll still get recorded. They'll be identified by window ID or however SM or XSM identifies windows and applications, and it will get launched, or it will get recorded in .x session and then get launched the next time you go into your computer. In theory, like I say, I've never done this on any machine. I've never tried all of these things, but that's the theory. And if X11 was, you know, feeling like we were still using X11 going into the future, I would definitely give this a go because it does seem interesting. It seems of interest. But until I hear about, I mean, honestly, at this point, I don't think, and this is me just going on about Wayland and X11 again, but I honestly, and I could be wrong because I, you know, it's early days still, but I think that even if someone just, you know, they didn't like Wayland, they wanted to keep with X11. I think even if they forked F11, unless they made it remarkably simpler, I don't think I would necessarily be interested in staying on X11. I could be wrong. I don't have that much experience with Wayland. There might be some features that I just, you know, they're just missing. I can't believe I don't have them. This is horrible. Got to go back to X11. Maybe that might happen, but I'm just kind of thinking that X11 has so much to it at this point that it might feel a little bit of a relief to just kind of walk away from it. Not in anger, but just it may have run its course. We'll see. Going forward, we're switching to Wayland, everybody, and we'll see how that goes. So far, so good. On my laptop, I have no complaints. In fact, I quite like it. But certainly this session, like this X session, no, this podcast session, this week of researching for this group of packages that I've covered in this episode has been trying. There's been a lot of documentation that has just left me really wanting something just better. Not the technology necessarily, because I'm not convinced that the technology isn't good. I just am kind of feeling like maybe the technology is unwieldy and like people aren't maintaining sort of the all of the different parts. Because to me, it seems like X11 has a lot of components to it. But I'm not sure how many of those components actually matter anymore. And I feel like if Wayland hadn't happened, maybe the next logical step for the X.org project, maybe, would have been to carve out some of the stuff that we just don't maybe use all the time. Maybe not. I'm not an expert on X11. It could be that some computers are using those components, and you know, I'm just not aware of it. But I do feel like there's a lot there, and it can be pretty overwhelming, and I don't think it a lot of it I don't think really got documented very well. So I think maybe if Wayland wasn't over the on the horizon or in our front yard, then I think maybe X11 would have to just kind of be, it would be time for some serious maintenance. And maybe that'll still happen. Like I say, maybe someone will come up with something similar but different to X11, some alternative to Wayland. Maybe not. I'm not sure. I'm not minding Wayland on Fedora Linux on my laptop. We'll see what happens on Slackware 16 or 15.2 or whatever we're headed for towards. Wait, 15.1. So yeah, why would we skip 0.1. Either way, that's it for this episode. Sorry for the lack of the coffee break. I just literally just blew right past it. Didn't even realize I was missing it. But I have had coffee. Fear not. I've been drinking coffee. I'm not going to report on it yet. I'm going to report on that next episode. And believe me, it's a report worth hearing. I don't know. Actually, I'm just trying to create suspense. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.